People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. Now, my guest this week is Stephen Jubber, who's playing the role of Macduff, among other roles, in the Fred Abrahams production of Macbeth, which is on at the Theatre on the Bay, an extraordinary and award-winning production, which we'll hear more about in a moment. But let me just tell you a little bit about Stephen before he tells us about himself. He graduated from the University of Cape Town in 2006, and he's done many, many theatre credits, and you've probably seen him a number of times in a number of different roles. Rooster Hannigan in Annie, Riff in West Side Story, Sky in Mamma Mia, Johnny Smith in Hello and Goodbye, Steve Baker in Showboat, Hank in Jersey Boys. There's also Sunset Boulevard, Jesus Christ Superstar, The Merchant of Venice, and The Boys in the Photograph, High School Musical. It's quite a list here because Stephen Jubber, I must say, is one of those very, very versatile actors. Stephen, welcome. Welcome to Fine Music Radio.
Thank you, Rodney. Hello, listeners. And thank you for the very generous introduction.
Well, it's all here. And in fact, that's just an abbreviated version. Am I right in saying that you are a triple threat?
I suppose so, yes. It's been a very organic move from one discipline to the next. I'd say I got my start as a dancer, in fact. My mother actually has a dance studio, so it seemed like a very natural extracurricular activity to have. And so that's my gateway into theater. But I must say I always enjoyed the music aspect, and singing was always something that I tried to keep up. Whether it be I stayed for singing in high school or choirs in university.
Did you do all that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no. I mean, there's no way you can suppress the desire to perform. It will bite you one way or another.
Did that bite come very early? You said your mother had a dance studio.
Yeah.
So it's in the family to some extent.
Yes. Sister's an actor as well. And my brother is an artist, fine arts, but he now does graphic design, art direction, photography. So I guess the chances were very slim that the Jubber children were going to be businessmen or doctors or lawyers.
Okay, so did you go straight into it from school? Or as you said, even at school, you were dabbling.
I took a little bit of a diversion. Varsity, I mean, I know you said I graduated in 2006. I did not do theater and performance or drama or even music or fine arts. I graduated in law.
Oh, gosh.
Which was my attempt at trying to quiet the artistic urges in me.
But that's quite a thing to do as well. Law is a long and very sort of tricky degree, isn't it?
I did it in the sort of undergraduate stream, which basically gets you an LLB in 4 years. So I guess I was in a rush. I don't think they offer that anymore. I think you have to do it postgraduate. So I caught it in this kind of window period. And I think I was mainly influenced by legal dramas that I saw on television. I imagine myself making these grand speeches in a courtroom to a jury of my peers and some powerful judge. The truth is, I mean, you know, as we know, the legal profession is a lot of drafting, a lot of meetings, a lot of contracts and negotiations, and very few actual court appearances. I mean, you appear in court if you've done something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the acting side of you coming out, isn't it, that you wanted to be standing there reading a judgment to the jury.
Up in the era of LA Law, The Practice, Law and Order, all those shows just were, I mean, the high drama that plays out in the courtroom, or at least that those shows lead you to believe plays out in the courtroom. Yeah, yeah. It's very enticing.
And so you are, in fact, a qualified lawyer.
Oh, I think that would perhaps be too generous. okay, I can't add that to my credentials. I did my degree, graduated, so you know they can't take that away from me, but I didn't pursue it any further. I didn't take my articles.
Okay.
You know, I instead decided to disappear to the United States for a while, where I became a snowboard instructor. I mean, of all things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Had to find something to rinse the taste of 4 years of legal study. But I'm not ungrateful, because it did give me perhaps a critical appreciation for, well, firstly for reading, And just for general argumentation, I suppose. I mean, there's a level of discussion that happens before any theatre production needs to be embarked upon. You know, a table read, and then character analysis, textual analysis. So I wouldn't say my time in the Kramer Law Library at UCT was wasted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was certainly an interesting diversion.
But why snowboarding in America? I'm just intrigued.
Well, it was just South Africa doesn't get snow, does it? The novelty of going on that adventure was very high. I think my circle of friends at the time were very keen on making the break. And so I tagged along. I thought this was a great time. And it absolutely was. I mean, I never took a gap year. So doing it after completing my studies was almost better in a way, because I was at this kind of crossroads. Like, I don't know what I want to do with my life, but I do know that I want to have a good time. I think it's time for a little celebration.
And then you came back.
Yes. And the first thing that happened was an invitation to audition for a musical. Ironically. I had been noticed by the producers of Macbeth, in fact, Abram Sameer Productions. And they had seen me perhaps in a dance show. I know I had, as a student, I had danced quite a bit corporately, just as my kind of student job. You know, instead of wedding tables, I was doing a flash mob for Vodacom, for instance.
Oh, God, yes.
That
yes.
sort of thing.
That's original.
So
anyway,
they had seen me at some event and were interested to know if I could sing and act. I said, well, no, I can't, but thank you for the interest. So I declined the audition. But they were persistent, and I'm glad they were, because eventually they got me into the room and kind of talked me through it, and we bashed out a few notes on the keyboard and spoke through a couple of scenes, and I think they cast me on the strength of that. I guess they were quite persistent.
What was the production?
It was called In Briefs. It was an original musical written by Fred and Marcel about five guys in Cape Town, and I suppose the shenanigans they get up to on a Friday night.
Right, okay. Yeah. Now, Stephen Jubber, what is your first piece of music and why have you chosen it?
Well, if you want to look at the prehistory of why I embarked on this career as an actor in the first place, I think it had a lot to do with childhood role play. And the most, I suppose, common film influence to all the kids in the neighborhood was Star Wars. I mean, the cultural impact of that film cannot be understated. And I'm of an interesting kind of middle generation, which didn't catch the original films in cinema. We kind of got it on VHS. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, did we wear those tapes down. I mean, we would just watch it over and over again. We didn't have the same glut of on-demand television or just the number of films that were produced. It was like there were three Star Wars movies, that's all you get, and these are science fiction masterpieces. Well, okay, they're not masterpieces, but they are such commercially important science fiction films that they just had everything that a child could ask for. You know, swashbuckling adventure, a princess, a roguish pirate, a cool spacecraft, you know, aliens, an evil baddie. Yeah, these were very, very irresistible elements for childhood play. And so, as I say, all the kids in the neighborhood would meet up and we'd climb trees and pretend it was the Millennium Falcon. We were to rescue the princess from Darth Vader. So I think those elements planted the seed for my career. I just wanted to keep role-playing. I wanted to keep my childhood imagination alive. And this is, you know, this is a gift of a career.
So your piece of music actually is from Star Wars, I see.
Correct. Yes. Oh, man. John Williams at his finest. I mean, he is a modern master of the leitmotif, as we know. I mean, cinematic music owes him a great debt, I'd say. In fact, next to Walt Disney, I think he's the most highly nominated Academy Award recipient. I mean, he's a genius. And the piece that I've selected is, in fact, the Princess Leia theme from Star Wars, the motion picture. And it is beautiful and haunting. And I mean, particularly in the fact that Carrie Fisher is no longer with us, has an added element of poignancy. And also kind of touches on perhaps a little bit of John Williams's roots in jazz. I think his name back then was Little Johnny Sugar. Back in the 60s, he was a jazz musician. Anyway, so there's a wonderful flute solo. It ends with a beautiful string solo. It's a great piece of music. Thank you.
That's Princess Leia's theme from Star Wars, the music of John Williams. The inimitable, I think I can say, Stephen, John Williams, mm-hmm. the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the actor Stephen Jubber. I read somewhere about you, Stephen, that you have a very large collection of figurines, action figurines. Does this tie up with your fascination with Star Wars?
Absolutely. It all started with Star Wars, but I think when you couldn't be playing role play, sort of live role play with your friends, the fact that you could have little avatars of the princess and Luke and Han, you know, these action figures, in fact, you could play out your own adventures. And once again, that feeds into why I do what I do. Only I think sometimes it almost surpasses what I do professionally, because I have a groaning collection of action figures,
really?
Toys,
really?
Spaceships, vehicles. Yes, no, I absolutely love the stuff. And ever since the internet became a thing and a credit card appeared on the scene, I've been making additions to that collection. And it's been a collecting hobby that has, as I say, almost taken over my life. I now podcast on the subject. I have a YouTube channel. It's wonderful to have a hobby. I mean, one might say my career is my hobby, but then I'm doubly fortunate in having two hobbies.
Well, exactly. Mm. And just as a matter of interest, if you podcast, are you prepared to tell us how to find your podcast?
Absolutely. Well, the easiest way to do it would be to search the iTunes store for, it's called G.I. Joburg, which is a symphony of two words, Johannesburg, which is where we started the podcast, my friend and I, and G.I. Joe, which is a ubiquitous toy line from the, well, it started in the 60s, but I came into it in the 1980s and 90s, where they were sort of shrunken down to, I suppose, 3¾-inch tall soldiers that then allowed for a great range of helicopters and tanks and planes and, as I say, spacecraft. So it was a fully realized play pattern, which was, yeah, something that was never repeated, I don't think. I don't think toys are as gargantuan as they used to be, as they were in the 80s and 90s, because they've kind of been surpassed by video games and now tablets.
Well, and also maybe too young to remember dinky cars. Remember how iconic those were?
Dinky cars, they gave way to then Hot Wheels and Matchbox, which is more in line with my era. But absolutely, Rodney, we are connected in our playthings, buddy.
And do you use them? I mean, nowadays, what do you do with them?
So the channel on YouTube particularly started out as a review show. And of those, there are a few, and some of them do them a lot better than I do, because they have a greater access to these sort of things. I mean, if you're located in the Northern Hemisphere, you're obviously, the stuff is a lot more abundant, particularly in North America, where it originates. You can go to any kind of flea market and pick up finds. Unfortunately, in South Africa, we are oceans away from where the stuff is.
Yeah.
So it becomes quite prohibitive in terms of shipping costs. So they have a more exhaustive catalog of these toys, and obviously they would be able to give a more holistic view of the toy line. What I tend to do is take what I've got, and using my skills as an actor, I create little sketches, little plot lines, use them in kind of a live action puppeteering or stop motion animation setup, to create narratives, and people have responded very warmly to it. There was a cartoon that that accompanied these toys back in the 80s, and a lot of people are hailing my humble creations as a continuation of that cartoon series.
Oh, well done, Steve. That's
Thank
an
you.
Extraordinary sideline, actually, and yet it's still performing.
Oh,
in
yes.
a sense, it's acting, it's directing,
yes.
it's using
it.
Voices.
Yes, yes, I direct my voice actors, and thanks to what I do for a living, I have access to some wonderful voice talents who have very kindly tendered voices for my my silly little fan films.
So remind me of the address again.
Yes, sorry, I don't think I even told it. The URL, well, once again, easiest these days to just go to YouTube or go to iTunes or Podbean, which is another site that we host the podcast on, and just type in G.I. Joburg. That's the letters G.I., different word, Joburg, as in
okay.
Johannesburg.
And then you would find your blog and the sort of stuff that
absolutely.
You talk.
Oh. So podcast, iTunes, and YouTube.
I'm going to do that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. I'm going to die of embarrassment.
No, you're not.
Stephen playing with his toys.
But Stephen, Apart from those three original Star Wars that we spoke about, the great iconic ones, isn't it amazing how, when these very latest ones have come out, how the essence of the film and the stories and the feel is the same, even with massive advances in technology? Or yeah. Do you not agree?
Well, I think the beauty of Star Wars in its original iteration was that it made fantastical adventure out of limited means. Mm. Nowadays, computer-generated effects can realize worlds. You know, the only limit is your imagination. But back then, they had to work out practical solutions for realizing these worlds. How do you make an enormous mechanical, you know, walking monster? How do you realize that? How do you create worlds that look otherworldly and yet, you know, you can't create them in a computer? You have to use actual locations, real actors, puppeteering, stop-motion effects. I mean, the amount of technological innovation within the practical cinematic realm that Star Wars created is staggering.
Yeah,
a lot of modern filmic techniques owe a lot to guys like George Lucas, Dennis Muren, all the effects department guys. And that innovation has just continued, I suppose. But, you know, I think there is something to be gained from looking at artists working within limitations.
Everyone's trying possibly a little bit harder than they would normally.
Absolutely.
With the assistance of computers and graphics and things.
So I would favor the more practical effects, seeing models instead of computer generated imagery.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, now while that sinks in, what is your next choice, Stephen?
Well, I can't add musician to my resume, but there was a time when I played a fiddle, and I'm grateful for it because it gave me an appreciation for music. I can read music. I doff my hat to career musicians because it is a lifelong pursuit. I mean, there is no end to the amount of hours you can put into your instrument. I was not that patient a performer, to be honest. But there was a time when I was a violinist, and one of my matric pieces was Dvorak's Slavonic Dance. And the version that you're going to listen to is for full orchestra, and it's beautiful to hear all those embellishments. I had to make do, of course, with a solo violin and piano accompaniment, but it's still a piece that has enormous resonance for me. It takes me back.
Thank you.
Music by Dvorak, the Slavonic Dance, Opus 72, number 2, which was the choice of my guest, Stephen Jubber, the actor, who is in the Theatre on the Bay, Fred Abrams' production of Macbeth, which is now on at the Theatre on the Bay, and which has been having a run. Let's just talk briefly about Macbeth, Stephen, because you've just had a run of shows for school children, haven't you? And how do they react? Because Shakespeare's not easy, and I think the whole trick here is to get people to see it on stage rather than on the page.
Absolutely. I can't imagine. In fact, I don't need to imagine. I can recall being a student and being presented with text and it being kind of carved up each English period amongst the class. Everyone would take turns at reading various roles and to a lesser or greater degree. I mean, some guys didn't really care much for Shakespeare at all, and obviously they didn't make much sense of the text. So it really does die a death in the classroom, sadly. Maybe they do it better these days, but back in my school career, that was no way of actually... You couldn't even get the broad strokes of the plot, let alone the beauty of the language. So to see professional actors who've taken the time to really work through the text and highlight the important parts and treat Shakespearean text with some reverence, hopefully will bring it to life. I know in the experience that we have in the theatre now with the school's audiences, the response is definite. They get it, which is wonderful. You know, they gasp at moments of suspense and they cry out at moments of horror. I mean, it's remarkable. I sometimes take it for granted. Adult audiences can be quite dour. Like, school audiences are very lively. I'm sure there is a degree of, you know, friends showing off for their friends, but at the same time, that kind of unrestricted, unleashed response, it's very heartwarming.
And they listen, do they? They listen, they gripped, they concentrate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it most certainly, I mean, to paraphrase Marcel, who plays Macbeth, he would often say that, you know, Shakespeare is meant to be seen, it's meant to be heard, it's never meant to be read. You know, handing someone a Shakespearean text and expecting them to enjoy it purely in the word for the first time, having never had any kind of prior experience with Shakespearean text, is essentially like handing someone, you know, a score to Beethoven's Ninth. It's just notes on the page.
Marcel said exactly that to me when I was interviewing him about like the score to Beethoven's Ninth, which would make sense unless you hear the full orchestra playing it. So that's a very good analogy. And these kids, do they interrupt? Is it more difficult to play to kids?
There are a few bold kids out there
trying
who,
to show off.
I can't even call them kids. Young adults. I mean, they are perhaps in grade 11 or grade 12, so they're dealing with Macbeth as a set work. And yes, they do interrupt from... I mean, I wouldn't even call it an interruption. I mean, we're talking about a piece that was played to very disruptive audiences back in Shakespeare's day. Yeah. They were coming and going and throwing fruit, so we believe. And so it was, I wouldn't say a fight, but certainly a lively back and forth between the players and the audience. And maybe that's a little bit closer to how it's supposed to be.
There's a thought. Rather than a stiff upper lip... adult audience, as you say, being dour.
Yeah.
Not that I'm planning to scream and shout. But Stephen, you said earlier about the classroom and some of the guys just didn't get it. Did you, in those days when you were that young, did the text do something for you? Could you feel, did it speak to you as a young man, the Shakespeare text?
Gosh, I wouldn't overestimate my own intelligence as a 17 or 18-year-old. I mean, there is a level of almost academic study that needs to be undergone in order to fully appreciate what Shakespeare has done. But I'd say the broad strokes really landed. I mean, some of his speeches are so evocative. They speak on a very primal level, even if not all of the language is clear and all of the kind of imagery is clear. Mm-hmm. I'd say if you're getting 20% of it, you're still getting pearls. And hopefully was getting more than 20% of it. I know I got a pretty decent pass in English Lit. So.
Good. And do you find that Shakespeare, the text, is fairly easy to learn? Because you've got long monologues and things in Shakespeare.
They say that monologuing is easier to learn on your own than dialogue, because to get dialogue kind of moving freely amongst actors can take some doing. But gosh, Shakespeare text is a challenge. You want to be word perfect, because the words themselves are perfect.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
set into a pentameter that is meted in a way that gives added meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're ending on a weak stress, there is a reason for that. And if you're ending on a strong stress, so, you know, everything that he put to paper informs how the character's feeling, the attitudes that you're supposed to evoke from an audience, you know, giving you clues as to how to play it. So it's always going to be a challenge, and always going to take a little bit longer than perhaps learning contemporary text, which is written in more clipped fashion and more perhaps friendlier on the speaker. Shakespearean text uses a number of long sentences, and you need to break them up and you need to breathe, because there's nothing more tiresome than an actor who's attempting long soliloquies and just winding up breathless by the end of it, you know, just really scraping the lungs. And it's, you know, it's disconcerting to listen to.
Absolutely. Mm. And one of the things I also read about you, because you call yourself self-trained, but you've worked with fantastic directors, and Fred Abrahams has quite a reputation. We spoke about his Hamlet earlier, and this is a similar sort of take on Macbeth. But it must have been, has it been quite an experience working with him on Macbeth?
It always is. He, I suppose, is my first and last lecturer. I mean, in the sort of the school of hard knocks, as it must be when you're kind of learning the job on the job. I'm equating Fred with Shakespeare. Fred has been invaluable as a teacher. He takes time with actors. He will grind something out of you. You know, whether you want it or not, whether you are resistant to it. And he has a very, very easy way of doing it. It's never forceful. It's always a sort of a guidance that is sometimes a little tongue-in-cheek. You know, the man does love to use humor. But at the end of the day, I think if you listen to him, take in what he says, it's so beneficial. And it really has shaped who I am these days on stage.
Gosh, that's a wonderful compliment to Fred.
Well, he is a wonderful director. Absolutely.
Now we're going to have another piece of music, Mr. Stephen Drummer.
Mm.
What have we got this time?
So, we're actually, there's a common thread running through these pieces. They kind of follow me chronologically almost. I don't know if a number of your guests have done this before. I'm sure they have. But this next piece is Eric Whitaker's Sleep, which is a piece that I performed in the UCT choir, which I think might have been my more memorable time in university. I mean, all that time spent in the law library, that kind of rinses. But singing with the UCT choir is definitely one of those memories that I will always cherish. And what a wonderful gift to music Eric Whitaker's choral works are. It's just so rewarding as a choir. Every voice part feels like it is the main part. I suppose that's the joy of writing such tight cluster chord.
So here we have Sleep by Eric Whitaker.
Please close your eyes.
That's the music of Eric Whittaker, a piece called Sleep. And as you heard there, a really rather hypnotic style of writing and for the voices as well. And beautiful words. Mm. Do you know any of the words, Stephen?
Oh, I can recall a few. The poetry of it is quite beautiful. I mean, this is a wonderful lullaby almost. I mean, the words are so evocative. Upon my pillow, safe in bed, 1,000 pictures fill my head. I cannot sleep, my mind's aflight, and yet my limbs seem made of lead. If there are noises in the night, a frightening shadow, flickering light, then I surrender unto sleep, where clouds of dream give second sight. Yeah, no, I mean, if you are struggling to sleep, this is a lovely number to just put on.
I know, I feel quietly. Like listening to it again. Mm. But we'll do that after the show. I'm talking to Stephen Jubber, the actor, who is playing the role of Macduff in the Fred Abrams production of Macbeth, which is on at the Theatre on the Bay. And I just want to talk a little bit about that production, because we sort of hinted at it slightly earlier, but I remember with Hamlet, he sort of set it on a ship and with a pond around it. So tell me a little bit about this one, and I know you don't want to give too much away.
Mm. So Macbeth is, it's set in a sort of medieval Scotland, and a lot of the backstabbing and intrigue happens around banquet tables. It's kind of a key location in these kinds of tales. And, I mean, the set is structured around a gargantuan table with a few fun tricks installed into it. And the table is, it can be a metaphorical space, so it can kind of double as a mountain peak, but then also a very literal banquet table. And, I mean, if you are familiar with Macbeth, it involves assassinations and warfare and magic and all these cool things that the kids really love these days in you know, popular media like Game of Thrones, for instance.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's an interesting analogy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Shakespeare wrote it all several hundred years ago. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, right? But it is extremely popular. And the set, I think, gives us that platform to play in these spaces, you know. Mm. Gives us an elevation off the theater deck, which, you know, you can use to place status or as I say, geographical elements like a cliff face. If you're giving a big speech to assembled thousands of troops, you are essentially putting yourself on kind of a, I don't know, almost like a pulpit and addressing the audience as if they're your troops. I mean, it's, yeah, they're interesting techniques being used within the performance, which keep it quite varied, I'd say.
As we record this, I haven't seen it yet. And now, for example, I'm waiting to see how you people do The Three Witches, how Burnham Bush comes to Dunsinane. So it sounds, and knowing Fred, Marcel and Fred come up with this themselves, don't they? They come up with this concept. They sort of, it's their
absolutely.
Own thing.
Absolutely. And we spoke about, with Star Wars, for instance, and me liking the practical effects of old over the more computer-generated effects of today, and that limitations breed artistic excellence. Well, we have presented essentially a six-hander Macbeth. This is a play that could be played with, you know, hundreds of extras.
Yes,
you know?
Indeed.
And yet we've created an absolutely laser-focused plot line with just six actors, doubling up. And the reason being, I mean, this was taken on tour. Its initial life was at the Craiova Shakespeare Festival in Romania, which is an international festival with invited guests from around the world. Of course, the costs of getting a production that's sort of 20-hander, 40-hander up there is astronomical. So they did a very, very, I suppose, bonsai version, 6-hander, and yet the plot is vivid. So they've employed a number of very clever techniques.
And it's all male, isn't it? It's six males playing all roles.
Yes, yes. Perhaps I'd like to think of it as a statement of these roles could be, you know, played in any number of configurations. It doesn't ever have to be gender specific. There are all female productions of Macbeth happening. In fact, you know, the whole concept of there being two genders is, of course, very dated. So all of a sudden, every role is up for grabs for every actor. There's no bar in the industry now.
Let's move swiftly on to your next piece of music, Stephen.
Yes.
What is your next piece of music?
Okay, so we're now fast forwarding to my professional career in musical theater. I was very fortunate to be cast in the touring production of Jersey Boys, which is a cool jukebox musical about four guys who grew up in New Jersey and went on to become rock superstars of the 1960s and 70s. This number is called Who Loves You by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, of particular significance to me because I met my wife on this tour. And it comes at the end of the production of Jersey Boys, where Frankie Valli turns to the audience in a spotlight and says, "They ask you, what was the best part? The Hall of Fame? Pressing all those records, pulling sherry out of a hat? It was all great. But four guys under a street lamp, when it was all still ahead of us, the first time we made that sound, our sound, when everything else dropped away and all there was the music, that was the best. That's why I'm still out there singing. I'm like that bunny on TV with the battery. I just keep going and going and going, chasing the music, trying to get home."
When the tears are real.
Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, that piece called Who Loves You, a special piece for my guest, Stephen Jubber. And you say, Stephen, you met your wife on a show with this. And how long ago was that?
That was in the end of 2012. And subsequent to that, we've conducted a long-distance relationship between South Africa and Australia, eventually tying the knot end of last year.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
But Stephen, that reminds me, right at the beginning I spoke about your versatility, because for a long time you were cast sort of Prince Charming because of your looks and all that. And
I remember Rodney, we can't stay young forever.
But now you've done everything. You've done mad comedy. I saw you in that play about the play that goes wrong.
Oh, yes.
People will remember you maybe from Matilda, trying to get your hat off when they glued your hat to your head, which was a bit of a tour de force, may I say.
Jeez.
And also the things like the hotel plays, really like quite intense plays from Tennessee Williams that Fred Abrams had directed in those hotel rooms at the Vineyard. Do you have a favorite, or do you enjoy the versatility? Do you enjoy the variety?
It's the spice of life, isn't it? Absolutely, I enjoy the versatility. I enjoy being used to my full extent. I mean, if there is a part that fits my voice in terms of singing and also has great dramatic elements, I think that would probably be the winner. But to date, I have gotten enormous satisfaction from having a wide range of different, I suppose, facets of myself that various roles have called upon. Mm-hmm. And most recently, I'd say something like West Side Story has been a test of all of those faculties in one piece. I mean, it is the mother of all musicals, and it is, particularly in the way that it was presented here at the Cape Town Opera House by the Fugard Theatre, it was extremely energetic. They opened up the entire stage, front, rear, side stage. I mean, we were running. We were sprinting. How often do you get to sprint from one end of the stage to another? So it was a physical challenge on top of, you know, the dramatic stuff. In one instance, you're throwing punches, and the next you're hoiking a girl over your head. It's it is an extremely, I mean, particularly the first act for the character that I was fortunate to play. It's
that was Riff, was it?
Yes, yeah, it's great fun. Mm. I think he has the best fun.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah.
And you looked great.
Cheers. Well, I will say this much: playing that role in that production, it's probably, you know, the best shape any actor's ever going to be in, because as I say, you're throwing punches on the one hand and lifting girls on the other and belting out a show tune, jumping off a cop car. It's great. And all with the accompaniments of the, well, it's essentially a full orchestra.
Yes.
That is a rare treat as well.
And that fantastic
era where,
score.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Man, Bernstein at the height of his powers. And yeah, no, it is a treat. It's something that will go down as one of my favorite moments, to be honest.
Well, we're going to hear an excerpt from that to see you out of the studio. But first of all, I was astonished just very briefly to discover that you're still involved with Matilda. I thought that had long gone and gone to bed, but you're still touring.
Well, it's gone to bed for South African audiences, sadly, but the production is still alive and kicking. Our production of it, called the Eric Tour, so-called because it is the smallest of the of the touring productions, is geared to visit China for 7 months. We'll be playing in every major city, basically.
Stephen, you're very lucky because you're an actor that's in work. You're doing a lot, and it's great.
Agreed.
And it's been great talking to you, Stephen. So at last to have you on the program. I can't wait to see you as Macduff in Macbeth. And then it's back to Matilda.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Rodney, for having me.
Thanks. So we listened to this excerpt from West Side Story. America, what could be better than that?
Absolutely. Toe tapper. Very, very, very evocative stuff.
Stephen Jubber, thank you very much.
People in each room.
Automobile in America, chromium steel in America, wires for wheel in America, very big in America.
I drive a Buick through San Juan.
If there's a road, you can drive on.
Oh. I give my cousins a free ride.
How you get all of them inside?
go to America. Many fellows in America. Nobody goes in America. Why don't we go in America?
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. This May, Peter Turin presents Macbeth at Theatre on the Bay, starring Stephen Jubber, Matthew Baldwin, Talon Ramsamy, David Viviers, and Marcel Mayer in the title role. Does absolute power corrupt absolutely? Don't miss Macbeth. From the 15th of May to the 1st of June. Directed by Fred Abramser, only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now.